Hey everybody, my name's Travis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Travis.
Billy, thanks for asking me to come speak tonight. I appreciate that. It's always nice to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I'd also like to thank Merv for driving and Elizabeth for coming up tonight. I appreciate that. And it's nice to know I have friends who are willing to make the trip up to Madison to support me while I talk. And my sobriety date is September 30th, 2002. And like Mike said, I am a member of the Common Solution group in Charlottesville, Virginia. We meet on Thursday nights at 7:30 at the Hinton Avenue Methodist Church, which is right near the downtown mall in Charlottesville. So if you ever find yourself in the area on a Thursday night and are looking for a meeting, please come on by. I do have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and I do sponsor people. So that puts me square in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I like to be. I don't think, as long as I stay there and stay active, I do believe that I will continue to be sober. So it's very important in my recovery and sobriety to, you know, have a home group, to stay active in that home group, to have a sponsor, stay current with that sponsor and talk to him, you know, regularly and let him know what's going on in my life and get some thoughts and suggestions for what Alcoholics Anonymous may suggest would be a solution for that. This is my only suit jacket. I have one suit, I have one jacket, and normally I save it for, you know, weddings, funeral, court, of course, been there a couple times. It is quite warm, so I'm going to go ahead and take this off, if y'all don't mind. So thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, you know, the fellowship, everything that is AA, service work, thanks to participation in that, practicing the 12 steps in my life, you know, a home group and a sponsor, and the subsequent spiritual awakening and having a relationship with a God of my understanding, you know, I'm sober today and living a life of recovery. And saying that I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous can conjure up lots of thoughts and ideas. And simply for me, what that means is that I've had the personality change sufficient enough to recover from alcoholism. That I've had a psychic or personality change which allows me to no longer, you know, obsess and compel over alcohol to drink it. And, you know, it manifests itself in my life in numerous ways. You know, because it's easy to say that in the 12th step, when it reads, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, it's like, well, how do I know I've had a spiritual awakening? Well, if you've taken the first 11 steps, it tells you you've had one. But what does that mean? You know, what can you explain that in more greater detail? What does that mean? And to me, it means that I think about God sometimes, not all the time. I think about helping people when I can, again, sometimes, not all the time. I do things that are of a spiritual practice in nature. I pray, I meditate, I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where I try to carry a message of hope and recovery that this lifestyle and this sobriety and recovery is available to anybody who's willing to put forth the effort. And the effort involves, you know, taking the 12 steps and becoming an active member here. And those are, you know, some of the things that before Alcoholics Anonymous I never did. And my parents took me to church. They took me to Sunday school. They tried to instill in me the God of their understanding and religion and spirituality as what it meant to them. I never got that. I never identified with that. I didn't like going. I didn't want to be there. I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know what God was, or meant to me. I had no personal relationship or personal understanding of what God was. And so it didn't quite stick. It didn't quite sit in with me. And at some point, probably in my teenage years, I decided I was not going to go to church or Sunday school with my parents anymore. They didn't like that. And that didn't go too well with them. But they were, you know, willing to let me make my own choices. And then some years later in college, I probably turned my back on any God whatsoever. I don't know if I was an atheist or an agnostic or, you know, what I was. I just didn't think about that type of stuff. And I didn't have any animosity towards God. Like, the God that my parents tried to put in me wasn't a vengeful or punishing God. So I had, it just, to me, it was just a non-entity. I didn't think about it. I wasn't sure about anything. And that's kind of what I brought in to Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And in my first meetings, you know, it's brought up pretty quick. You start hearing things of, you know, spirituality, God, higher power. You know, it's in the 12 steps. You start seeing this stuff. And, you know, I brought a lot of, I don't know what it was that I brought with me towards that. Just a lot of negative baggage, I guess, towards that end. And wasn't really sure what I was getting myself into or whether I even wanted to stay here. But the fact is, I came with a lot of consequences from my drinking that had beat me into a state of reasonableness to have an open mind about it. And that's kind of how I got involved. And at my very first meeting, the person who gave me my white chip later became one of my good friends, both in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, became a member of my home group, and he gave me my white chip, and that was just by chance. He happened to be the person giving out the chips that day, and it was my first meeting. And afterwards, he gave me some really good advice. And he told me, you know, if you're going to meetings and you're not sure what's going on, you know, listen to what people are saying. If somebody says something that has weight and depth and meaning or strikes a chord with you on a personal level, go up and talk to that person. That will be a good person for you to go talk to after the meeting. And a couple weeks went by, and then I was at a meeting, and a gentleman said something that had weight and depth and meaning to me that struck a personal chord with me, and I had never heard anything like it before. And what he said was, God is on the inside trying to get out, not on the outside trying to get in. And, you know, I know today that that's kind of an ancient spiritual belief. I know today that he was paraphrasing from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it talks about deep down inside, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental concept of God. I know that the Christians refer to this as the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit. The Buddhists refer to it as the divine spark theory, but typically it's an ancient spiritual belief that inside of every living being there's a little spark of the divine and a little concept of God that we can find, and we can let that light and let that part of God out. But I'd never heard anything like that before, and it kind of hit home with me, and I went up and I talked to him, and this is the gentleman who then became my sponsor. And when I asked him to be my sponsor, he didn't just say yes. He said, why don't we sit down, we can talk about it, and I'll let you know, what kind of expectations I have. Things that he thought would be very helpful to a newcomer trying to get sober and find recovery in their life. And what I've learned from him, I still practice today. And he did take the time to spend with me, to take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to show me where the directions were in the big book. He spent countless hours listening to me talk about problems of the day or week or month. And most importantly, he talked to me about getting a home group and being an active member in AA, going to lots of meetings, getting there early, staying late, helping set up the chairs, helping make the coffee, pitching in. And one of the other most important things he talked to me about was going up and talking to other people at the meetings. Because in early sobriety, I was very nervous. I was very scared. You know, I don't know if anybody comes into the rooms of AA on a winning streak or ready to just run out there and like greet and meet everybody and all outgoing. And I was, sidled up next to my sponsor. And I just remember after a meeting one day, he just pointed to somebody across the room and was like, go talk to that guy. And he started getting me in the habit of reaching my hand out and saying, hey, how's it going? Because what this does is, when I ask you what's going on in your life, and you start telling me about maybe what is going on, then I'm not so concerned about myself anymore. I stop thinking about my problems, and I start listening and trying to be helpful and useful. And it's a practical tool to get me out of my head. It's a spiritual tool, because what's more spiritual than trying to help another person? So before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have told you that I was alcoholic. Did not think I had a drinking problem. I liked drinking. I liked the effect it gave me. I drank to get drunk. I did not ever have one or two drinks. And it seemed to me that alcohol was providing more of a solution in my life than it was a problem in my life. Many people try to point out to me that I had a problem with alcohol, that it was causing problems in my life, and that maybe I should try to moderate or only have one or two drinks. And whenever they did, you know, I'd put up the wall of defensiveness, the wall of denial, the wall of delusion, whatever you want to call it. But I was like, no, 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 leave me alone. You don't know. You don't understand. I don't have a problem. I'm okay. And that was my story, and I was sticking to it. One time, I was home from college on a break, and my mom told me she wanted to take me out for lunch to buy me some new clothes for school. And I was like, that sounds nice, you know. I like to eat. I like new clothes. Let's go. And we get in the car, and we ended up at the psychiatrist's office. And the psychiatrist wanted to talk to me about my drinking. And I can assure you that that is not a good start to an intervention of sorts. Because immediately I was blindsided, I was caught off guard, and I was just like, leave me alone. I don't want to be here. And I think, you know, one of the important things about Alcoholics Anonymous for me and for it to, you know, affect change in my life is that I came in here willingly. When I came this time, it was because the consequences of my drinking had gotten so bad, and I was so full of shame and guilt and remorse and the weight of what could be going on, that for the first time in my life, I was like, show me where to go. Can somebody help me? What do I need to do? And this is where I ended up. But like I said, I wouldn't have said I was alcoholic before coming here. And it did take all those consequences to break through that. You know, and I don't know if, again, whether it was delusion, denial, or defensiveness. But even after coming in for a while, it would have been hard for me to say I was alcoholic, because I didn't know what that meant. And I brought a lot of preconceived notions with that. Whether it was somebody who was, you know, the brown paper bag bottle drinker on the park bench, or the homeless guy under the bridge, or somebody who'd been divorced or lost their job, or whatever those consequences may be. You know, that's kind of what thoughts came to mind, and that wasn't me. I wasn't married, so I couldn't be divorced, so that wasn't even going to apply, but I hadn't lost a job. I'd had some run-ins with the law, which I'll get into in a minute. But I'd had some consequences, but I always thought it was just because I like to drink. I like the effects of drink. I like to have a good time. And it was through working with a sponsor and reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous that I was presented with a pretty simple definition of what it means to be alcoholic. And it's the definition that Alcoholics Anonymous uses, that one or the other, doesn't both cases don't have to apply, but one or the other, if when you're drinking you can't control the amount you drink, or if when you stop you start drinking again, you might be alcoholic. And both of those applied to me, and it was through the discussion with the gentleman as my sponsor when we sat down that first time talking that he started telling me, you know, about how when he would have one drink or two drinks, it would always lead to three and four and five and six or seven and eight, you know, etc. And I saw myself in that, and that's, you know, when you start to drink, you can't control the amount, because hundreds or thousands of times I told myself, I'm only going to have one or two drinks tonight. I have to do something later this evening. I have to do something important tomorrow. I can't be hungover. Whatever the case was, I knew that I didn't want to get drunk, but I also knew, you know, the magic of the effect of alcohol, that it would help relax me and calm me down and kind of like take the edge off a little bit. So I still wanted that, but I just didn't want to go full tilt. And I'm a blackout, you know, fall down, you know, gray out, get drunk, get sick, you know, pass out, all that type of drunk. You know, when I start drinking, it's for the effect and it doesn't stop. And so hundreds or thousands of times that I told myself I'm only going to have one or two drinks, and I would go out and I would have one and then I would have two. And if I tried to stop at that moment, the next 20 minutes, maybe 10, 15 minutes would be the worst 10 or 15 minutes ever. It was so hard to sit there and be like, okay, I'm not drinking, I'm only having two, until finally it was like I had to have that third one. And that was always like, oh man, the third one was the best when I tried to control it. And then it was, you know, then it was all bets are off and I'm getting drunk. And so I identified with that, and I identified with it when somebody else told me that they drank like that and said that this is probably, if this is you too, then you may be alcoholic. And on the other side of that, I didn't drink 24 hours, 7 days a week. I had times of sobriety. I could go, you know, maybe a week. I was a weekend drinker, a binge drinker. Of course, the weekend started getting longer and longer. It started to be Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. Then Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Then, you know, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, Sunday, Monday. Tuesday was the only day not drinking, but that was at the end as it was getting worse. But there were times when I would go without drinking. And again, a lot of times something would just be like, I had a bad day. A drink will make this better. I know that will take the edge off. Or I had a good day. I need a drink to celebrate. And I had gotten to the point that every social event I went to was going to involve drinking. And it didn't matter what it was. Going to play golf, we're drinking. Going to the movies, we're drinking. And that's just how it had become. And I didn't recognize that as a problem. I did mention at the beginning that I had a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and participation in the fellowship and going to meetings and a home group and things like that. And I also want to kind of distinguish that from a time earlier when I was still drinking that I may have had a spiritual experience. And I was not drunk at the time. I was not drinking. I was completely sober. And I'm a landscaper by trade. And we use tractors or skid steers. And in a lot of these things, you can exchange the implement on the front end. You can put like the big steel bucket or auger bit or forklift bits, whatever it is. And you can lock them in place and then take them on and off. But they do have to be locked into place or they will fall off when you lift them up and roll them out to, like, you know, dump the gravel or something on the ground. And we had planted some trees and the trees had died. And we were going to yank them out of the ground with a chain that hung from the bucket. And then I was down on the ground. I was going to wrap it around the trunk of the tree and we were going to lift it up. So I'm laying on the ground and I'm giving the hand signals for the guy driving the skid steer to get in real close. And now he's going to raise up the bucket. And it's fine to raise it up, but it's when you go to roll it out, to pour whatever was in it, is that's when it's going to hit the point where it's not, if it's not locked in, it's going to fall. And that was just to get the chain to dangle down so I could get the chain and wrap it around. And I'm laying on the ground. You know, it's about 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. And as I'm laying there, a voice as clear as day in my head said, "Move, the bucket's going to fall." And of course, I questioned it, and I said, "What?" And it repeated, "Move now, the bucket's going to fall." And so I rolled out of the way. At that moment, the sharp edge of the bucket came down on the ground. It skinned my arm and bruised my shoulder. Could have hit me in the head, could have done all sorts of damage. The witnesses there who saw it were like, "How did you know? It looked, I've never seen you move so fast. It almost looked like you moved before the bucket fell." And I was like, "You know what? Something told me the bucket was going to fall." And I don't know if that's a guardian angel or if that was, you know, a higher power that I would call God, you know, blasting through whatever, you know, clamor and confusion and static I have. But it could very easily have been a spiritual experience. And I thought it was. If somebody asked me on that day what had happened, I would have told them that it was a guardian angel or a God of sorts had helped with that situation. However, I did not follow that up with any action whatsoever. The next day, I may have still been talking about it, but 2 days later, it was like it had never happened. Didn't talk about it, didn't follow it up, didn't start going to revivals or churches or acting like, you know, I'd had some great spiritual awakening or spiritual experience. But through Alcoholics Anonymous and the process of the 12 steps, you know, I feel I have had a spiritual awakening because I have continued to follow that up with the actions that we talk about that I believe keep me sober. You know, my sobriety is based on the continual maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I used to hear that wrong. I used to read that wrong. I probably heard and read it for 2 or 3 years that my sobriety was based on my spiritual condition. And that is absolutely not true. My sobriety is not based on my spiritual condition. Because my spiritual condition is on a spectrum. You know, some days it's really, really good. Some days I'm thinking about others, I'm being helpful, I'm being useful, I'm praying, I'm meditating, and my spiritual condition's way over here. Other days, it's really poor, and it's over here, and I'm not praying, and I'm not meditating, and I'm full of selfishness and self-centered thoughts, and I'm full of fear and resentment, and I'm acting on this stuff, and I'm being a jerk and a terror in people's lives. I'm inconsiderate and maybe even dishonest. Most of the days, it's somewhere in the middle. And that is not what my sobriety is based on. My sobriety is based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Am I going to meetings? Am I going to talk to other people? And I prefer to talk to trusted members of my home group or my sponsor and other alcoholics, because these are the people that I've come to believe think like me, feel like me, and drink like me. And if I'm ever in a bind and I got something going on and somebody's rubbing me the wrong way and I'm getting ready to let them know that they're not doing it right and I'm going to set them straight, you know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous are the ones that can talk me down off that edge and give me some other thoughts and be like, "Hey, maybe have you tried praying? Have you tried talking to another alcoholic? Have you tried helping somebody? Have you tried turning your thoughts towards helping somebody?" So it's through that, it's through the maintenance of my spiritual condition that allows me to stay sober. And I only learned that through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the guidance of a sponsor and participation in a home group. Also, you know, I said I never would have thought I was alcoholic before coming to AA. You know, I know today that I am absolutely 100% alcoholic. Like I said, I fit that definition. And then we go to meetings a lot, and people are always talking about how it manifests itself. And it manifests itself in my life through those things I was just talking about. When I'm on the low end of the spiritual spectrum, resentment, fear, selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonest behavior, inconsiderate behavior. And I have that stuff too. So if that's how alcoholism can manifest itself sober, or drunk, you know, I got it. And I got the idea that the allergy of the body, that when I start drinking, I can't control how much I drink. Before coming to AA, I never would have thought that I was alcoholic. I would have had a hard time admitting it. But I may have told you I was crazy. I may have told you about some of the crazy thoughts that were running through my head. I didn't want to be alcoholic, but it was okay. You know, how silly is that? It's okay to be stark raving insane. And one of the ways that used to manifest itself was at night, I would wake up with all sorts of weird things going on in the house. There would be, I don't know, like vortexes or portals to other worlds opening up in the wall, ready to either suck me out or allow other beings through. The aliens were coming to visit me, so to speak. I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking that the walls in the house were falling down, and I would actually have to get up and turn all the lights on and run around the house and put my hands on the walls to make sure, like, are they level? Yeah. They still standing up straight? You know, and, you know, people joke about it, but there's been movies that's been documented about, you know, you put aluminum foil on your head or line your windows with aluminum foil. That'll keep the aliens from reading your thoughts and keep the aliens coming. Now, insane. I'm crazy. I'm not alcoholic. I've got some weird stuff going on, but can't we just fix this with some therapy or some pills? However, through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous and getting sober and finding recovery, I am here to tell you, the aliens have stopped visiting me. So, like I said, it was the consequences of my drinking that brought me into the rooms of AA. And they started with the normal consequences I think a lot of people have, you know, falling down, passing out, getting kicked out of bars, fights with the friends, fights with the roommates, fights with the family. Hangovers. God, I hated hangovers. They were the worst. Trying to work, you know, feeling ill all day. And some days I just had to lay down in the seat of the truck during the lunch break. Just let me lay here for a while. You know, and then run-ins with the law, minor car wrecks, major car wrecks. Remember one time we were floating inner tubes on the James River down in Scottsville. They got those little operations where they run you up the river and drop you off and you float, and got so drunk I passed out in the inner tube on the river, and it was the one that ends at Hatton Ferry, and there's some rapids right there and you got to go past the ferry and kind of cut back in, and I'm passed out in the inner tube, and my friends are telling me this story at a later date, but of course I don't remember it. That some of them are like, just push him through, just push him through, he'll make it. And the other ones were like, no, he'll drown, you'll kill him, you know. And they had to actually, like, babysit me down the rapids and get me off the river. And, of course, by the time we drove back to Charlottesville, I was ill, sunburnt, passed out, getting sick, you know, all the fun stuff that come along with drinking. But those were just little speed bumps, little roadblocks along the way to my drinking. That type of stuff did not confront me in any way, shape, or form to say, I need to stop, you know. I don't like hugging the toilet. I don't like putting my head on the cool floor of the bathroom to feel better when I'm getting sick. I don't like, you know, of course I don't like that stuff. But if that's the price I got to pay for overindulging a couple times, I'm willing to do it, because most of the time alcohol makes me feel good and I want it. So I was willing to go through that stuff to continue drinking. Let's see what else. Fell off bar stools and bars, you know, just boom, right off, and then the bouncers come and kind of pick you up and throw you out, and end of that. Just lots of consequences of my drinking. I think that the first real major consequence of my drinking was a pretty serious car wreck. I'd been drinking all day, went to this festival in Charlottesville at the music amphitheater they have there on the end of the downtown mall, and they had bands. It was called the Blues and Brews, or Brews and Blues Festival, where they had blues bands and lots of different beers, lots of different microbreweries, and all sorts of beer vendors that you could, you know, try, get the little 3-ounce trial cup or the 12-ounce real one. Of course, I went for the 12 ounces every time, and got very drunk that day, continued drinking through the evening and into the night, went up into, I guess, you know, up 53 towards Monticello to a friend of mine's house who was having a farm party. Never been there before. Long gravel driveway, up dark, you know, it was at night. Got there, stayed, got sufficiently drunk there. And around midnight, or 11:30 or so, decided we were going to go back into town and hit the bars. Now, I've never been to this place. I don't know if I could have kept going up the gravel driveway, if there may have been a turnaround, but it appeared to me that it was a farm and that there was open fields everywhere and I could just do a 3-point turn and head out the other way out the driveway. And as I go to do the 3-point turn, it was not an open field. It was only about 4 or 5 feet off the edge of the driveway, and then it dropped down a very steep embankment to the farm pond. And I basically just backed my truck right over the edge of this. And I'm talking really steep, like this steep, you know, like sitting in the truck like this. And it was a stick shift. It was four-wheel drive. I tried to put in a four-wheel drive. I'm going to climb back up out of that. But being a stick and I'm being on such a steep embankment, trying to let off the clutch and engage the gears, it rolled back a little bit. And when it rolled back, it hit a steeper part of the hill so that the two driver's side tires came off the ground, and we flipped one time completely over and then another half, and we're upside down. And I had my roommate, his sister, in the car with me. And, you know, my roommate was probably my best friend at the time. I had his sister in the truck with me, and we're upside down. Did not realize we were upside down in a pond yet at this moment. And I was like, okay, we're fine. Nobody's hurt. No, yeah, I was a little bummed that my truck's upside down and off the road and down the bottom of an embankment, but we're okay. We'll get out of this. And I go to open the door, and when I did that, water started gushing in. I mean, gushing. It was coming in quick, and I was like, that's not good. So I shut the door. That's too late. By this point, you know, whatever seal was broken, and it's filling up. And it's filling up, you know, to my waist, to my belly button, to my chest. And as it got about to my neck, I turned to my roommate's sister, and I apologized for killing us. I was like, I'm sorry, but we're going to die. Luckily for me, she was not as drunk as I was, and she was like, we're not dead yet. Let's roll down the windows and swim out. And I'm like, good idea, Nancy. So we roll down the windows, we swim out, we climb up this steep embankment, and we start walking back to the farmhouse. Now, at this moment in time, the thoughts that are running through my mind are not, oh my God, I've just totaled my truck, I've almost killed myself, and I've almost killed my best friend's sister. That is not what was going through my mind. What was going through my mind was, I need a drink. I needed to calm my nerves. I needed to settle down. Go back, knock on the door, stand there soaking wet. It's October, it's cold, and my buddy opens it, and I'm like, Sean, you got anything to drink? I need a drink. My truck's in your pond. And he's like, no, Travis, the party was over. Everybody was going home. And in fact, you were the only person who still had beer left in your 12-pack, and you took it with you. You know, and he's like, you jerk. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right, I did. So I went back down that hill, dove in the pond, and swam back in the truck. Now, I was completely prepared to hold my breath and find the beer and swim out. But when I got in there, there happened to be a pocket of air. Still didn't fill all the way up, so I was actually able to come up and take a deep breath. And I sat in there for about 5 minutes and contemplated things. And grabbed all the beer. Figured it was a good idea to take my keys out of the ignition. I might need them later. And got home, you know, drank a few beers. By this time, my buddy, who I was going to be at the bars, had called, like, where are you? What's taking you so long? He came back, got me, and we left the truck there. And when I went home and continued to go out to the bars. And that's what happens to a guy like me when I'm in the, you know, the thralls of the alcoholic obsession and compulsion and the allergy. When one beer leads to drinking two beers, which leads to drinking three, and I can't control how much I'm going to drink, no matter what happens or what gets in the way, I'm going to drink till I get the job done. And that's just how it is. The truck was totaled, by the way. Pulled it out with the tow truck the next day, flipped it over, opened it up. There was like muck, like pond muck. It was nasty. There were like green stuff in there, little newts running around. And a mechanic friend of mine thought that the best way to possibly save the engine would be to drain all the fluids out of it. So I climbed up underneath of it and removed the oil, drain valve. 2 gallons at least of just water poured out. I never saw a drop of oil come out of that. Water, water, water for about 30 seconds. And then the oil started coming out. And it was not rebuildable. And I don't know. Something else I was going to say about that, but I think that about sums it up. Total loss. But that didn't stop my drinking any way, shape, or form. Continued to drink like that for a while. Of course, there were all the jokes about, hey, Travis, next time you want to go fishing, get a boat, not a truck. I was sick for about 3 or 4 days after that, like physically ill. I was nauseous. And I don't know if that was from, just the scare, the shock of, going through an accident like that, or whether it was just nasty pond scum water that I may have drank and had some sort of biological, illness to. But, I could have possibly, and for some people, prompted a change in their drinking, but not me. Continued to drink and live my lifestyle like that. I did drive drunk hundreds and thousands of times. I don't know why, and I don't know why I never got arrested or killed anybody. It's pure, the grace of God or whatever it may be, that didn't happen for many, many, many years. But if you drive drunk that many times throughout your life, you're gambling every time, and eventually your luck's going to run out. And I did. I started to get pulled over for driving under the influence. The first time, again, was after an all-day affair of drinking. 3 sheets to the wind, drunk. Been drinking since like noon. And then again, it was late. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. Had pulled over at a gas station. We were lost. This was in D.C., right up near Capitol Hill, and I don't know if y'all have ever been there, but there's a lot of the roads that they're all one-way roads, and they all have the same name. Like, I think there was like 4th Street East and 4th Street West type thing. And we were just on the wrong side. We were like so close to where we needed to go, but we couldn't find it. Pulled into a gas station to call, get directions. The way I was parked, the headlights were like shining out into the road. So I was, trying to be nice, trying to, be a good citizen there and cut the headlights off of the truck, but I didn't cut the engine off. And so after the phone call, when I got back in the truck, it was running, ready to go, so I just drove away. Got pulled over like 5 minutes later for driving without my headlights on. And there was all bets were off at this point. There was no way I was going to pass the field sobriety test. There was no way I was getting out of this. We shouldn't even have bothered with the little test. And I remember he asked me if I knew my alphabet. I was like, yes. And he was like, start at K. And I was like, great. It starts at A, dude. And so didn't go too well with that. Arrested, taken to jail, and blew a .19, which actually turns out to be a blessing, because in the District of Columbia, the laws are way different than they are in Virginia or Maryland. They're actually more lenient for some reason. And the fact that I was a first-time offender and blew less than a .20 blood alcohol content qualified me for their federal program of first-time offenders. So I was able to get that transferred to Virginia. I was able to go through the 10 weeks Virginia Alcohol Safety Awareness Program, BASAP. I was able to have my, you know, parole here and deal with that, you know, check in with people and things like that. It was all here in Charlottesville. And when I went through a year of that, was then able to go back to the court in D.C. and have all the charges dropped and the case dismissed, and there was no conviction on that. And that turned out to be a real blessing, because when it happens again, you know, it just still looks like a first-time offender. And I remember when I went back to D.C. for my court, and I had to apply with the judge for this program. It wasn't just granted to you. The judge had to, like, give it to you. And if the judge decided not to give you the federal program, then there was, you were guilty and you were going to jail. And there was no right to appeal on this. So if there was a slight risk in attempting to qualify for this program. And, you know, it started off with a lot of questions about, did I understand what I was doing? Did I understand the laws? Had my lawyer, you know, talk to me about this? I was like, yes, Your Honor. Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, yes. And then the questions got really hard. Then it was like, how much do you drink? How long have you been drinking? You know, do you have God in your life? And all these things. I was like, whoa, you know, my mom and dad are in the courtroom. And I'm just, the judge is grilling me with tough questions. You know, and I'm under oath, and I'm doing my best to answer honestly. And the one about, you know, do you have God in your life was a stumper. Because remember, at that point, I had turned my back on all that stuff that my parents had given me. And I was standing there, and I didn't want to lie, but I knew that that was a really important question. The judge would not be asking this question if it was not important for whatever reason. And as I sat there, the answer that came was, I was raised in a Christian household. It was not a lie, but it was as close as I could get, and that seemed to satisfy her. And she granted me the program, and like I said, I went through it. And everything was great, except the whole time going through the program, I did not want to change anything about anything. I continued to drink the way I'd always had. I just didn't want to get in trouble. I just wanted to get out of trouble. And I remember when I left that courtroom, the guy, out of all the craziest things, a guy I had been handcuffed to that night at 3 a.m. And he was a real big guy, so wherever he wanted to go, I went. You know, he's walking, I'm just getting drugged around. We were being processed and arrested at the same time. I'm handcuffed to him, we're sharing a cell. He happened to be in the courtroom. And when I'm done and the judge has grilled me with all these questions and everybody in the courtroom heard it, when I was done, he just looked at me and he was like, good job. And I was like, thank you. And but it didn't change anything. You know, I continued to drink and I got arrested again. And when I got arrested the second time, it was in North Carolina. They weren't too keen on having a good old Virginia boy come down into their fine state, breaking the laws. So they didn't want to let me go. They wanted to keep me in jail. The bail was like $15,000, I think. I don't have $15,000. I don't know who to call. The only person I could call was my mom and dad. And they own a small business. And it just so happened that on that Friday, they didn't make it to the bank on time. And that they weren't able to deposit the funds. And my mom just happened to have $1,500. You got to put down 10% when you pay a bail bondsman. And so she just happened to come, and they drove through the night and got to North Carolina and bailed me out of jail. And when we got in the van to drive him, not a word was said. Not a word. And we drove the 4 hours back to Charlottesville in complete silence. They didn't need to say anything, because by this time, I was caught in all my lies. I told them after the first arrest, I told them hundreds of times throughout my life, don't worry about me. I'm okay. It's okay. I'll never do that again. It's not a problem. But there I was in the exact same situation again, less than a year later. And all that weight, all that guilt, all that shame, all that remorse, that fear of whether I was going to go to jail this time, whether I was going to be able to get out of it, whether I was going to lose my job, all this stuff but mostly just that I knew, this time I had done it, that I had hurt my parents beyond repair. They never said that to me, but that was my thought. I was like, this time I'm not going to be able to heal this wound. I've done it. And that's how I came back, full of stuff like that. And it's those consequences that I believe beat me into a state of reasonableness, so that when I was finally like, I need to do something, I need to heal this, I don't know what to do, can somebody help me? That at that moment, I was ready for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was willing to accept what was offered here. The things like get a home group, get a sponsor, go to lots of meetings, you know, pitch in, help set up chairs, help make coffee, help clean up, and take the 12 steps and see what happens. And when I got here, I was a little like, whoa, what is all that stuff about God and higher power? But I had an open mind. I was like, you know what? I'll try it. And you get to the second step when it's like, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I didn't know what I believed about God at that moment. And thankfully, my sponsor didn't put any pressure on me. He was not like, you got to believe right now. You got to know exactly what God is. You need to say, you know, amen and hallelujah and say you believe in God. It was none of that. He was like, are you at least willing to say maybe? Can you at least say you don't know and have an open mind about this? And I was like, I can do that. And then it was in the third step, and it was, you know, we said a prayer to a God of our understanding. Well, at that moment in time, the God of my understanding was maybe. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but I don't know. But that was the only understanding I had, and that was sufficient. It was okay to say the prayer. And even the prayer, which I didn't know how to pray, was kind of given to me. You know, say something like this. You don't have to use the exact words, but here's a prayer written down in the book. Say something like this. And again, that was good too, because that prayer is full of these and thous and all sorts of religious stuff, but I didn't have to use those words. So I just changed it to very simple things like you and he, you know, made the pronouns a little more in modern English. And it was very helpful that through this whole process, it was baby steps, and there was never any pressure along the way. It was just keep moving forward, keep taking the action, go through these steps. And you know, and the action gets harder when you get into the fourth step, and you got to write stuff down, and then you got to share that stuff in the fifth step, and then the ninth step, you go back and you tell people where you were wrong and how you hurt them and what you want to do to make this stuff right. But I went through the process, and I did it willingly and openly and continually. And I think that's important, because like I said, as long as I continue to practice the principles that I've learned through that process, that's part of the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And it's through that maintenance that I stay sober. And I continue to put into practice those things that my sponsor said were important in early sobriety. You know, go to lots of meetings. Go up and talk to the person who's standing there alone in the corner. You know, reach out and take an interest in the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess so, the last thing I want to say is, you know, that relationship with my family was a little damaged there. When I made my amends to my parents, I told them about all the times I had stolen the liquor from the liquor cabinet or pilfered my mom's purse to get $10 to go, you know, buy some beer somewhere, and all these things. And I want to make that right. I want to give this stuff back. I want to pay for it now. But I was also told that I can't possibly know all the ways that I've harmed people. They know how I've harmed them. I only know some of them. And that I should be willing to ask them, how else have I harmed you? And what can I do to make that right? And my mom was honest with me. And she told me about all the times that she didn't know where I was and laid awake at night worrying about me. She told me about all the times that I ducked out of the family dinner because I didn't want to stick around for dessert, because I wanted to go out with my friends and have a few drinks. She told me about the times, and remember, I'm a landscaper by trade, that how I didn't come over and help with the yard when she asked me to. And I was like, wow, you know, I've really, you know, my drinking caused strain in this relationship that I didn't even know about. And then, you know, and I'm feeling right after that second arrest that I've done it this time, that I can't possibly heal this up. And I'm going through the process of the amends, and I'm starting to hang out and stay for dessert, and I'm starting to, you know, participate in their life more, and I'm calling them, and I continue to do these things. You know, I have a very good relationship with my family today. And, you know, maybe my sister shouldn't have told me this, but she did, and I was about 2 years sober. She was like, you know, I was talking to Mom, and she said she's really mad at you still after all this time. And I'm like, what? You know, I'm doing this thing. I'm doing AA. I'm going to meetings. I'm spiritual now, and I'm taking steps, and I'm doing this stuff. And she's still mad. And I was like, well, you know, with the guy, my sponsor, he was like, just keep doing it, you know. Just keep doing it. And I kept doing it, and I kept calling. And there's two things that happened that I know the relationship was healed. One was when there was a really nice trip that my mom and dad and uncle and aunt and some other family friends were all going on. I was just joking with them. But I was like, I want to go. And my mom said, it would really mean a lot to have you go on that. And I was like, wow, you know. And I got to go on this trip with them, and it was really nice. And we spent, you know, 2 weeks together traveling. And then later, when my mom's friend started having trouble, and my mom's friend was drinking too much, and my mom's friend was having social services, child protective, you know, custody services type thing come in, thinking about taking their daughter from them, and there were arguments and fights out in the street. When my mom's friend was having all these problems, she called me and she said, Travis, will it be okay? Can I bring my friend to that meeting of yours on Thursday night? And I knew then that not only was my relationship healed, but that my mom knew that it was Alcoholics Anonymous that had done it for me. Thank you.